Dear brethren, we're going to be served at this time by Brother Jerry, and you can see the title of his talk on the screen share. One word, shalom. Brother Jerry.
Okay, can you hear me? Very good, thank you. I would like to thank the Chicago Brethren for your service and putting on the convention. We thank you for opening prayer, for the opening hymn. And since we've got the closing hymn of the convention, we thought it would be appropriate to speak on shalom. Once again, love from our brethren here in Hartford, where we meet. Now, the word peace is common in most languages. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. In the New Testament, the word for peace is irene, and the Latin word for peace is pax. And even though peace is sometimes used in the Bible in the sense of the opposite of war or in contrast with war, as it is in Ecclesiastes 3:8, where it says, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. To make peace means more than just the absence of war in a purely negative sense. It includes also the idea of friendly relations between two peoples. So when rival kingdoms made shalom in the Bible, it doesn't mean that they just stopped fighting. It also means they started to work together for each other's benefit. Now, on a more personal level, in today's culture, peace is usually thought of as referring to an inner calm and tranquility, free from worry and stress and anxiety. And in the Hebrew Bible, peace sometimes does refer to inner tranquility, but it more often points to something much better. Now, the most basic meaning, the core meaning of shalom, is complete or whole. Complete or whole. In one way or another, the idea of completeness or wholeness is involved in all the different uses of the word shalom in the Hebrew Bible. For instance, the common greeting in Israel is Shalom Aleichem, or peace be upon you. We could roughly translate this as good day, but it really is closer to may you be well. And to be well is to be whole, to be complete, to have the resources to deal with one's needs. The same word, shalom, is used to express health, welfare, well-being, security, and any number of other ways to express wholeness or completeness, depending on the circumstances and the needs of the person. But a core idea of shalom, and this really makes it quite unique to the Hebrew language, is that life is complex, full of moving parts and relationships and situations. And when any one of these is out of alignment or missing, your shalom breaks down. Some part of your life or relationship with others is no longer whole or complete. And in order to bring back shalom, restitution, recompense, reconciliation, or payment of some sort must be made. An example of shalom meaning restitution is found in Exodus 22:5, which reads, if a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field, and of the best of his own vineyard shall he make restitution. The word translated here, restitution, is the Hebrew word shalom. This law of restitution is saying if your animal accidentally or otherwise damages or eats the produce of your neighbor's field, you shalom them by giving them restitution, a complete payment for their loss. You take what is missing and you restore it to wholeness or completeness. An example of shalom meaning reconciliation is found in Proverbs 16:7, which reads, "When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him." And again, of course, the word peace is shalom. So when enemies become friends, it means the broken relationship has been reconciled and made whole. To reconcile a broken relationship is to bring shalom. An example of shalom meaning recompense is in Jeremiah 16:18, which reads, "And first I will recompense their iniquity and their sin double, because they have defiled my land. They have filled mine inheritance with the carcasses of their detestable and abominable things." Now, the word translated here, recompense, is the Hebrew word shalom. Because Israel had not kept the law, their relationship with God was out of alignment. It was incomplete and it was broken. And God is telling them the only way their relationship can be restored or made whole is through a process of recompense. In this case, a period of disfavor. And after their 1845-year period of disfavor is completed, shalom shall begin to be restored. Now, two examples of shalom, meaning pay, are found in 2 Kings 4:7 and Psalm 50:14. We'll read them both. 2 Kings 4:7 reads, "Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go, sell the oil and pay thy debt, and live thou and thy children of the rest." And Psalm 50:14 reads, "Offer unto God thanksgiving and pay thy vows unto the Most High." In both of these scriptures, the word pay is the Hebrew word shalom. Both these instances are about paying a debt. In one case, the debt is owed to man. In the other, it is owed to God in the form of a vow. The widow woman made shalom of her debt by restoring which is owed to her creditors. The individual who is instructed to make shalom of his vows to God will do so by completing or finishing what is owed to God in that particular vow. Now, shalom is not only applied to people and to relationships between people. It is also applied to things that are finished and that are then in a state of completeness or wholeness. An example of shalom meaning finish is found in Nehemiah 6:15, where it says, "So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. Here, the word finished is the word shalom. Shalom was brought to the wall. It was finished. It was made whole. It was completed. And now we'd like to address the theological use of the word shalom. The Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, speaks of Berit Shalom, or covenant of peace. The covenant initiates or begins a relationship which is based in some sense on mutually assured obligations. Each side will undertake and perform certain actions in order to fulfill their obligations to the covenant. So in a covenant of peace, or Berit Shalom, we see the notion of peace as an action, part of the mutually assured obligations or actions between God and man. One such covenant of peace is found in Ezekiel 37. In verses 1 through 14, we have the prophecy of the dry bones coming back to life. At the time of the prophecy, the nation of Israel was in captivity in Babylon. The prophecy gives hope that the Israelites would be reanimated as a people and be restored as a nation once again. It also is a prophecy of the millennial day, when Israel would be regathered from the tomb and as a nation. Their hope that was lost of being heirs to the Abrahamic promise of blessing all the families of the earth will be restored. The dry bones prophecy is followed by the prophecy of the two sticks being joined and becoming one nation. They will be gathered and brought to their own land and shall have one shepherd, David, who is the Christ, rule over them. And in Ezekiel 37, verses 26 to 28, we read of this time, "Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will place them and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Yea, I will be their God, and they shall be my people, and the heathen shall know that I, the Lord, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore." This Berit Shalom, covenant of peace, is the New Testament. It is the new covenant made with Israel, as Jeremiah 30:31 says, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." God's obligation under this covenant of peace is that he will, through the Christ, the mediator of the new covenant, bring mankind to a condition in which they can obey and live. Jeremiah 31:33 tells us how God will fulfill his obligation under this covenant of peace. In order to make it work so that the people under the covenant can be faithful to it, unlike the covenant that failed, God says, "I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people." And what are the obligations of Israel and the world of mankind under the covenant of peace? It is simply to listen to the mediator in all that he says, and to obey and live. As Psalm 34:14 says, "Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it." Here the psalmist tells us that shalom is not something that simply happens. It is a thing that one can work on and lay hold of. And this is what the world of mankind will do as they walk up the highway of holiness, as they seek after human perfection. In Zechariah, we have another prophetic picture of the kingdom and another meaning given to shalom, which is complete truth and justice. Zechariah 8, 16 and 17 reads, "These are the things that they shall do. Seek ye every man the truth to, or speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor. Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor. And let no false oath, and love no false oath, for all these are things that I hate, saith the Lord." Here, Zechariah joins the notion of peace with judgment or justice. Shalom is used here in its meaning of complete justice. And shalom is also joined here with peace. When truth and justice are done in the gates of the city will have shalom. The city will have justice. So in this passage, peace, truth, and justice are all associated with each other. They are parallel terms. In this, we see a profound truth to the meaning of peace. It is far beyond the simple idea of a cessation of war or the absence of conflict. Nor is peace seen as limited to inner calm and tranquility. It really comes very close to meaning justice. Peace is seen as the deep commitment to the work of justice. And this helps to explain the role and the work of the Prince of Peace. In Isaiah 9, 6 and 7, we read, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth ever forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." The Prince of Peace is not said to put an end to strife or to bring inner calm and tranquility, even though these will be the result of his kingdom. Here, Jesus, the Prince of Shalom, is seen as a bringer of justice, and his government or his kingdom will be established and sustained with complete justice and righteousness. This idea of the kingdom being wholly submerged and covered by justice is echoed in Isaiah 66:12, which reads, "For thus saith the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river." This peace is the mark of the new heavens and the new earth. Complete justice will flow over it as a river, and none will hurt or destroy, and no injustice will be done in the kingdom of the Prince of Peace. Now, one other thing which makes shalom very unique to the people of Israel is that every aspect of their peace, of their shalom, whether it be freedom from war, wholeness in physical and mental health, prosperity, security against drought or crop failure, you name it. The peace, the shalom of Israel, was all dependent on how well they kept their covenant. If they faithfully kept the law, they were promised to be blessed in every aspect of life. If they failed to keep their covenant, they were promised cursings, both personal and national. The ultimate curse being captivity to a foreign power and loss of their promised land and national sovereignty. And of course, we know how it all worked out. We know how much peace they had. They certainly had their ups and downs when it came to being faithful to God and their law covenant. They complained about the lack of food in the wilderness. They made and worshiped the golden calf when Moses was up in the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments. They didn't fully take all of the promised land, leaving pockets of enemies that God had to continually raise up judges to deliver them from. Their first king was unfaithful in doing God's command, and he lost his anointing. When he tried to kill his successor, Israel's second king had some problems of his own in the affair with Bathsheba and Uriah. The third king, the child of that union, had issues with foreign idolatrous wives. And the fourth king saw the kingdom divide. No longer 12 tribes united, now two kingdoms, one 10 tribes and the other two. Why so much trouble and turmoil? They didn't keep the law. They worshiped idols. They had false prophets. Their leaders didn't rule justly. Then finally, the ultimate penalty for unfaithfulness was brought to bear. They went into captivity, first to Syria, and then Babylon, then Medo-Persia, and then Greece, and finally Rome. When they rebelled against Rome, their nation was destroyed, and they were dispersed into the surrounding nations. So all in all, not a picture of perfect peace. But that is as it was meant to be, because Israel was a type that demonstrated that shalom could not be achieved through the keeping of the law. The law was a schoolmaster to bring them unto Christ and into a personal covenant of sacrifice that brought peace with God through faith in Jesus' blood. And that is what shalom is all about in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, the word most associated with and translated peace is the Greek word eirene. In Christian thought, eirene is, quite naturally, deeply influenced by the use and meaning of shalom in Jewish thought. Like as in the Old Testament, peace in the New Testament is also used as a greeting and as a departing salutation. It is also used to describe the security involved in peace, security from theft, or from averting war, or from release from persecution. It is also used for reconciliation after an altercation between two people, or the end of a disagreement within the church. It describes an international calm and a relationship of goodwill between God and man and a state of wholeness among a group of people. As followers of Jesus, we are instructed in Romans 12:18, if it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. In Mark 9:50, Jesus urges us to have salt in yourselves and have peace one with another. Jesus wants the relationship among his disciples to have integrity And he wants us to make real efforts to keep our fellowship intact. And along this line, Paul urges us in Ephesians 4:3, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And what will be required of us if we are to do this? Verse 2 tells us that it will require humility and patience and bearing one another in love. In other words, it will take real effort. In total, in the New Testament, there are 11 imperatives to seek and preserve peace, and several specify to live at peace with all people. As we can see, for the consecrated, peace is a very high priority. But Jesus makes it plain that we are not to live at peace solely by what the world terms peace, because what the world terms peace is not our goal. It is not what we are laying down our lives for. In John 14:27, Jesus tells his disciples, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." The implication here is that the world's peace is not God's intention for us. While it is important to try to live peaceably, having peace in this world is different from the peace that Jesus gives. This false peace that Jesus is referring to might be the peace the world was under during Jesus' life, which was the Roman peace. This would be the Pax Romana, Pax being the Latin word for peace. Might have lost our picture. Okay. Caesar's peace, or the Pax Romana, was obtained through military conquest and enforced by violence of a most brutal nature. The Roman emperor was very proud of the Pax Romana that he had brought to the empire. So proud that on one side of the denarius, the coinage of the realm, is pictured a seated lady who represents Pax, the embodiment of the peace of the empire. In 1 Thessalonians 5:3, in an allusion to the coinage of all worldly empires, Paul warned about the rulers who promised peace and security with these words, "For when they shall say, peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape." As important as the Pax Romana or worldly peace may be, Paul, who was a Roman citizen and he could appreciate it, is saying, it is a mistake to elevate the contributions of the Caesars or the Kaisers or the Czars or the kings or the presidents have made to peace. It is a greater mistake still to glorify or even deify the emperor or the peace of the empire, because their peace was all, without exception, obtained through oppression, and all worldly governments will be destroyed and discarded in the day of the Lord. Worldly peace, then, is not true lasting peace.